who wasn't quite sure who all was going to be here, so we'll work on that, okay? But that's a deal. So I wanted to sort of, I always start this out with making you guys be aware that pediatric oncology is a field that's moving quickly, and it's a field that's actually had more survivors than all of the adult fields have had. So we now have plenty of survivors out there that you will run into, in that they'll be in your classes, they'll be in your communities, and they may have ongoing issues, and sort of sitting back and thinking about that. But you're also going to be asked by people, what does it mean to have pediatric cancer? You know, I heard this person was sick. You know, this kid was sick. What does that mean? Do you know anything about this? And at least this will give you a little bit of a primer on it. The hard part about this particular lecture is I was asked to do all of pediatric oncology, which is a little bit, okay? So I'm going to focus a little bit as we do this. But one of the biggest things that you have to understand is that these are, unlike the diseases that we get as adults with oncological diseases, we do it because we eat the wrong foods, the cycling of the grass. We do all of those things over time, and so it's sort of a use slash abuse problem. In pediatric cancer, it's one of development. And so I can pretty much tell that this kid who's coming in with an abdominal mass, who is three, has these probable cancers, because that's when that organ is developing. And that when they're 10, it's this kind of cancer. So we can start to sort of separate them out that way. Do kids cross over the lines? Absolutely. But you can actually see where they're gonna, where they develop and where it happens. Can everybody hear me without me standing behind the podium? Good. Okay. So what we don't know, and what a lot of people don't realize, is how prevalent childhood cancer is, and that while we are still, while there are fewer kids who get cancer than an adult, the number of years lost is much higher when you think about the fact that a three-year-old had 70, 80 years that they could have had. And that may be the child that was going to think of the next great scientific experiment. So if you think about it, every day 46 kids are diagnosed with cancer in the United States, and yet we have only 4% of the funding in the United States. One in 330 children will develop cancer by the age of 20. If most of them are survivors, you're going to see them. You may have survivors out here in your group that you run into every day. And although we have done better, we still lose about a quarter of them. So we quote 80% because our survivors, because most of them have very common cancers that we've learned how to treat. But the kids who fail our upfront therapy, or the kids that have some of the more aggressive tumors, still are not surviving. So we need to be looking at that. So it is still the number one cause of disease, of death, in children after accidents. And so it's important to understand that we are still not there yet. And so everybody sees notes that say, oh, HIV or muscular dystrophy. Understand childhood cancer is still the number one killer. When we look at that, accidents, especially as you get a little bit older, homicide and suicide come in. And we do see that kids who die from congenital anomalies relatively young. But cancer is still taking a huge number of children every year. And then what kinds of cancer? Well, the adult cancers are very different. So as an adult oncologist, I would be responsible for breast, or I would be responsible for GI tract, or leukemia, or lymphoma. But pediatric cancer, there just isn't enough patients to say, okay, I'm only going to do that. So we actually concentrate on all of them. But if we break these down and look, a good majority of children who present with an oncological diagnosis are going to present with leukemia. There's another group that is a large group, and that's the CNS tumors. I think that as we move on, the CNS tumors are the ones that we're suddenly going to be able to open the black box of the brain and be able to say, oh, wait a second, this tumor is from this, and this tumor is a different cell line, and so it's going to have a whole different biology, and I should treat it differently. Right now, for the most part, I treat it by cutting it out, radiating it, and for a subset of the patients, I do chemotherapy. But I do that, you know, I don't cure all those patients, and so we have these big groups that we need to start teasing apart. And that's where the science of oncology really comes in. We need to be able to tease these kids apart and be able to say, I'm not going to give you so much toxicity that these late effects that Dr. Rupert is going to talk about are life-limiting or activity-limiting, but I'm going to cure them. And so we've got to pull these kids apart. Our next commons are lymphomas, and they tend to be aggressive in pediatric oncology. And then you can start to see the real, where people start to think of the tumors of development. Neuroblastoma is the sympathetic system developing, and it's doing it incorrectly and gaining mutations. Retinoblastomas tend to occur between birth and about 5 or 6. After that, you don't see a retinoblastoma in an older patient generally. Okay? And then Wilms tumors, the same thing. Your kidney tends to develop. I've seen or helped care for one patient who had a de novo Wilms who was a young adult. In all of the time that I've done it and in any of my colleagues. It's rare. It happens, but they tend to be more aggressive. They don't tend to be following the rules. Does that make sense? So, what do we know about it? We know a lot about adult oncology and that we're starting to learn that certain things will cause cancer. What we do know about pediatric cancer is that most of the time we don't know what caused it. We know that there are some chromosomal abnormalities that put you at risk. Okay, kids with Down syndrome have an increased risk of ALL. Kids with various genetic abnormalities have an increased risk. If you have Fanconi's anemia, you have an increased risk. Do you guys know what Fanconi's is? No? This is one of the great stories. Fanconi's anemia is a group of diseases in which it's a DNA breakage syndrome. So the patients can't repair. And what they found was that by mixing different extracts and cellular from different patients, they could complement each other. So they fall into complementation groups. And these patients present with leukemia, they present with marrow failure, and as we've gone on, it was an orphan disease, as they sort of piece each of these proteins that are part of the complement, different parts of the complementation groups together, only to find out they had it pretty well worked out, only to find out that BRCA1 and BRCA2 are part of that Fanconi's complex. Okay, so it all came back together. How they all interact vary in how they're coming in and why some patients get leukemia and some patients get breast cancer and some get marrow failure, we have yet to figure out. Okay? And that's where we are looking. If we have identical twins, we have a concordance rate of 20% if they're less than 6. So my 2-year-old that presented a year ago and her identical twin, she presented, and now we have to figure out how we're going to watch the other twin. The question is, did they take the hit as genetically they took the hit, or were they in utero and got the same hit that allowed them to start the process of going down through through leukemia? You can also have environmental. We don't see much for radiation except around Chernobyl. We don't see a lot of chemical carcinogens, and there's no evidence that I fed my kid the wrong thing. So we tell our parents, this is not your fault. What we do know is that viruses are a part of Burkitt's and are a part of Hodgkin's disease, but we don't know what they're doing. And that was actually the focus of my fellowship research, was trying to sort out what they could be doing in there. And nobody still knows. Why does 20% of Hodgkin's still have the EBV virus within it? Why is endemic Burkitt's have almost all of them in Africa be EBV positive? We don't know. And then, of course, immunodeficiencies. The more we stress your immune system, the more likely you're going to get a pediatric lymphoma or leukemia. Does that make sense? Okay. So ALL is our most common disease. People will ask you, is that a good cancer? There is no good cancer, okay? ALL is one that we cure the most of. So our low risk, what we call standard low risk kids, we cure 98%. What does that tell you? We're almost curing too many, you're probably over treating a bunch of kids, okay? And that we might have toxicities that we're gonna have to think about that are long term. Our standard risk kids, which we'll talk about in a minute, we're more in the 90% range, and then we fall off with the high-risk kids. And the high-risk kids are our older kids. We still cure more of the adolescent and young adult population than the adults treating the same population. So they're trying their our protocols in their patients now. What do we know? There's peak incidence around 3 to 5 years. What happens to your immune system around 3 to 5 years? Anybody? Do we have a lot of switching? Hypervariable areas? Somewhere in that time? So we are stimulating our immune system, they are trying to generate their immune system, and they mess it up. Okay? Does that make sense? Whereas when you're an older person and you have ALL, that's a different hit. Okay? This is a very, very active immune system. There's more boys than girls, and I don't remember the exact percentages. Okay. This is always hard to tell. Have you guys seen a bone marrow? Yes, no, maybe? We numb the kids up. Actually, most of the kids go to sleep, which makes it much easier to position and such. And we numb the area over the iliac crest, and we pull marrow, and we're actually pulling it fast enough to break little blood vessels. So the first pull is handed off to look under the microscope. And this is an example of what a first pull looks like. And one of the biggest things you should notice is they're all different. I see red cells, I see neutrophils, I see some big blobby cells that are probably early, that may be glass, but you see variety. Okay? Now I do the same test over here. Do I see variety? No. I see monotony. And what I see is a very lacy nucleus. And so I look under that microscope and say there isn't enough variety. There isn't a condensed nucleus, and I can actually pick out nucleoli. That's an early cell. That's a blast. Can I tell you that that's a leukemic blast? I can only tell you because there's so many of them there. You all have 1 to 5% blasts in your marrow as normal blasts, is what we call them. So who's going to help me figure this out? Because I'm not that good at histology. Okay. So I'm going to send it to Anne-Marie. Okay. She's going to tell me if it has any mutations that I should be worried about, and I'm sending it to flow cytometry, and they're going to run my panel for me and tell me what kind of cell I have. Okay. So if you think about it, and I come from my fellowship training in which we call things high-quality stem cells, low-quality stem cells. And so way up here, oh, it is. Way up here is a high-quality stem cell. It spits out cells. That's Rick Jones's way of talking about it in Hopkins. It spits out occasionally, and it doesn't replicate very much. And then it starts to spit out cells, and the low-quality stem cells start to be seen. And they're not bad cells. They're not as pluripotent. And so they spit out cells, and they start to go down pathways. And so the attempt is usually to try to find out what pathway you're going down and what cell is bad when you're thinking about some of this. So multiple myeloma, where's the mutation that started this? How should I think about that? And pre-B ALL and other forms of leukemia. So let's just go down this pathway for right now and go lymphoblasts. Well, I start with a lymphoblast, and this cell, while this picture shows it as it's already there, there's multiple steps, because I need to know whether I'm going to be a B or a T, right? And I can't tell by looking at the microscope. And so I'm going to figure out that it's a B or a T, and I'm going to go down this pathway, and that's what flow is going to help me. If I'm way early, I'm called a pro-B ALL, and I don't cure those very well without going and doing something very aggressive, okay? Mature B ALL is Burkitt's leukemia. It's a mature cell, and I treat that differently. What I'm looking for most common pediatric tumor is pre-B ALL, okay? So it's partway down this pathway. It's not way early, and it's not way late. Does that make sense? Okay. And then, of course, the AMLs, which we're going to talk about, is everybody else, okay? See? We sort of just group them together and treat them very similarly. Okay, so how do kids present? They present with pain. Their bones are filled with leukemia. Their marrow is. It's pushing out, and it's making the other good cells go away because there isn't room. And so how do we do that? Well, what do you see? Well, we can see high white counts, or we can see low white counts, okay? And that's going to come down to what does that mean from a treatment perspective. You can have anemia. You can have anemia. Push all the red cells out. thrombocytopenia, so they can have nosebleeds, they can have horrible bruising, and they can have high turnover of cells. And so because you're letting them let go all the DNA and RNA, you start seeing all the uric acid. We call that tumor lysis when we start seeing all that. We can have CNS disease, which is not that common, but it can cause problems with headaches. You can have testicular disease, and so the boys notice that they're more swollen. We look there to make sure they're okay. And then we also, I'm not going to go into this at detail, but we have a host of other things that can be similar in that mononucleosis can give you pancytopenia. Okay, so we see that. CMV, cytomegalovirus, can do the same thing. ITP can cause your platelets to fall, and it's an immune problem. So all of those things are part of our differential. Any questions yet? No? Nothing? Okay, so we're going to do that bone marrow aspirate that I just talked about. We're going to look at it under a microscope, and I'm okay if I can tell that there's a bunch of cells, and we actually will go, hey, you know, what did you think it was? What do you think it was? But it's really the pathologists that help us out. They do immunohistochemistries, flow cytometries, and cytogenetics. So because of these two groups predominantly, we usually have an answer within hours for a family. We do a lumbar puncture to see what's in their spinal fluid, and we start to tease out their prognosis. We know two things when they walk in the door. We know what their white count is, and we know their age. It's not good to be a baby, and it's not as good to be older. This is being teased out, because now we realize that kids that are 13 and older probably have slightly different disease than 10 to 13. You know, and so we're starting to tease them out. We're starting to look for Philadelphia chromosomes, like diseases. So not Philadelphia chromosome, because we've looked for that, but some of the mutations that are similar in that they're hitting tyrosine kinase sites. We look for favorable chromosomal analysis and unfavorable. So we'll get a callback from cytogenetics that says, that kid is hyperdiploid. Good thing to be. That kid is hypodiploid. Bad thing to be. Okay? That kid has a tau AML mutation. Good. Okay? And we're going to go through during that period of time and figure that out. We've learned over time that minimal residual disease. You'll hear people say MRD. Have you heard that already? Yes, not me. MRD, minimal residual disease. How fast you respond to your therapy tells us how good you're going to do. If we still see MRD at day 28, we are now getting much more worried. Because those are the kids that before we started teasing them out, were dropping the percentage of survival because they were the ones that were, many of them were the ones that were relapsing. Okay? So MRD has become our favorite discussion. So this is a typical, you guys have done this, right? So you're looking for, she's going to give us our mutation. So we have a Philadelphia chromosome in this one. Flow cytometry telling us that we are HLA-DR positive, HLA-DR negative, but CD10 positive. So there's certain markers that we're very used to. I'm not going to write a test question, but what's the marker? Okay. Oncology in an hour doesn't get that. Okay, so we're going to find out if it's a T cell, is it a B cell, what lineage is it, where is it, and I'm going to figure out my treatment. I'm going to look for high-risk and very high-risk patients, and I'm going to start clearing them out. I'm going to get them to an MRD that is a very low number. We're still trying to figure out what's the perfect number at what stage. Okay? We're going to give them a 3-drug regimen if they're between the ages of 1 and 10 and less than 50,000. And we're going to give them a 4-drug regimen if they're greater than 10 or more than 50,000. Those cells are doing something different. There's a different mutation we just don't understand. And where everybody is trying to tease it out. We're going to say you're in remission at the end of 30 days, hopefully. But we've not done the chemo because we just took it, taken the tip of the iceberg. We're going to intensify and consolidate your remission, and we're going to maintain it. And we're going to give you CNS prophylaxis, lumbar punctures usually, about once every, well, there's a lot initially, and then they spread out to once every 12 weeks. And we're going, right now we treat boys a little bit longer. In the next series of studies, that hasn't proven to be that much. That didn't really help and just had toxicity. But that was for the privileged site of the testicles. So that we made sure we got that. And that's how we get to a cure. Dr. Rebecca is going to talk to you about the fact that curing is not without its late effects. Okay, so then I added some slides, and you guys can tell me if I, yes. CNS, but we know that if that chemotherapy will not enter the spinal fluid because of the blood-brain barrier unless there's, well, there's certain chemos and certain doses. So instead of trying to go high on the dose to get it into the CNS, we simply deliver it using a spinal cap.
So
it's
because it's so common that it spreads?
Yes, it goes there. B cell goes there, but T cell goes there even more. Your lymphocytes like to, are able to traffic into there. Mainly to help you with a viral infection or a bacterial infection, but these are in the same family, so they have the potential to get in there. And so, depending on how much leukemia is in your spinal fluid, you usually just get spinal taps, but you may end up with radiation as well. And because we are pediatric patients, if I get radiated to 1200 gray, I'm fine, okay? I've learned what I'm going to learn. I might take a little bit longer to learn some things, but if my three-year-old gets radiated through that, I might not learn how to do math as well as I should. My reading might be a little bit slower. I might take a little bit longer to do things. And so we're very cautious because we have the developing child. Does that make sense? Okay. So now the patient didn't get the MRD, so they're refractory. Or if they relapse. Well, the old world was, let's give them more chemotherapy. We'll just change the chemo up, we'll give some more. But the problem is, and you guys probably all, some of you probably studied this, we have drug resistance. These drugs were intended, I mean, these proteins were intended to keep you safe when your ancestors were hunting and gathering and ate the wrong berry. They pumped out the drug really well. That was in that berry. However, if you have cancer and they don't want you to pump that drug out, then it's a problem, right? And so we're all trying to figure out ways to get around what we already know, what our body did as part of our survival, is now something that can hurt us when it's chemotherapy. So we give them more therapy. We give them a transplant. We give them a new immune system. We used to say, yeah, we'll just give you a new, get so much chemotherapy, we'll give you a bone marrow transplant, which is what I do as my subspecialty in this field. And I'll give you new cells and you'll be all okay. We realized that the immune system was part of this because if you got your transplant from your identical twin, you did not do as well as you got it when you got it from your other family member. So we have an immune basis. So we tell the immune system to go after it. We've been doing it for a long time. Now, the things that you probably have been hearing about a lot, I'm going to go in reverse because of the way I have my slides done. We've been using targeted therapy based on mutations for a while. If you have the Philadelphia chromosome, use Gleevec. Use the second generation and use the statin. I have a young lady who has a mutation in c-KIT, and we're trying to go after it with the statin. So we're using those drugs to try to target a little bit. So many of our kids are tested either upfront or when they are not behaving like they're supposed to, we test them, okay? Through, right now we have to do as a sample, but Omniseq will be hopefully doing liquid tumors in the near future. So we have these targeted agents, and they are used a lot. Let's go to what's in the news all the time, okay? You guys heard about CAR T cells? I am not an immunologist. So basically, we send our patients right now, we have to send them away, okay? And I stole this picture. I admit it freely, okay? Do not copy and replicate it to everybody else, okay? Because I did the stealing. So the patient goes down. Right now we either go to Sloan or Philly, and they get a large catheter put in, and they get the cells pereased out of their body. They're going to get their lymphocytes taken out. They can have leukemia floating around. We don't really care right now, okay? We just want to have a high enough T cell count to be able to collect it. We then put them through and we antibody coat the bees and we get a T cell, the T cells pulled out and T cell activate them. We're going to modify those T cells and expand them. Meanwhile, the patient's gone back to get chemotherapy because they can't wait. Their leukemia has relapsed. And they grow them. They're able to then suck the bees out and now they've stored and frozen them. Okay? Okay. So now the patient comes back and gets their modified T cells. So what they have is a T cell that looks for CD, for most the newest or the ones that we use most are CD19, and they go at, and then they inject them back into the patient. We usually give them a little bit of chemo before they do that. They drop their immune system so they won't clear them too fast. There are differences in those constructs. Philadelphia cells stick around a little bit longer. Sloan seems to give you more bang right up front. Okay? Who knows which is best? We don't know. What we do know is that they do tend to be able to clear patients of leukemic cells when chemotherapy wasn't going to. Do you have to do something to consolidate that remission, like a transplant? That is another big question. So CAR T cells are being used more and more. I will tell you that the adults tried to make this generalizable by a company, and they just ran into a major problem because the patients were getting sick from the T cells and dying. Okay? So it's not something to be done outside of a study, outside of careful observation. And that's why it hasn't been generalized all over the place. The best thing would be that if you could somehow get the cells to the place, have them generate them, and then send them back so that there's one place making, a few places making them, but that everybody can give them without making a patient get on a plane. Okay? So you'll hear lots of people talk about CAR T cells, because that's the big thing that shows up in the news recently, especially after one of our meetings. Then there's a drug, not that far off of that, it's called blinatumomab. And so if it's an ab, it's an antibody. If it's an ib, it's a small molecule. So we have an ab that has two parts to it. It has a part that can link to CD3, and it has a part that links to whatever tumor antigen, in this case, CD19. So I can infuse this. The person can go home with a little backpack on, if they do well for the first few days, and it infuses continuously for 30 days. We've done wonders for patients who won't tolerate huge doses of chemotherapy. We don't think that's going to be a cure if we have to follow up with a transplant, but we have another agent. These are the agents that are coming fast and furiously out of laboratories right now. They come almost always to an adult population first, but we're hooking on to them, and people are really looking. Okay? Does that make sense? I know a little bit about CAR T cells. Okay. So, AML. There's about 500 pediatric cases per year. So it's not as many as the adult population. There's no age or sex preference. You simply go like this. So the older patients, you know, that's what the line looks like. There's a few pediatrics, then they're younger, and then they start to have more and more patients. The only group that is different that has a pocket of early AMLs that we think about are the kids with Down syndrome. They can have a thing called transient myeloproliferative disorder in which there's blasts, and they simply go back away. And then about a third of them come out and have frank leukemia. We don't understand that whole group yet. They come just like the ALLs come, with the exception of, and sometimes they can give themselves away, gingivitis. They can come in with DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation. Those cells are the cells that are part of the immune system that is that has the granules that allow the cascade for bleeding, well, for clotting to occur, which results in using up all your factors. That's what's happening in those patients. Once again, we do bone marrow aspirates and biopsies, and we test to make sure that they don't have CNS disease. These kids are often the ones that, if they're going to have something, they can have this bump on the skin, and when you biopsy it, it's full of leukemia cells. That same bump can be in other places, like on cranial nerves, and the term for it is called a chloroma. Okay? So you remember the old picture. Now we have this picture. Once again, we have a lot of cells that are monotonous. We have an hour run. It's our giveaway. Not every leukemia cell, AML cell has an hour run, but it really helps to go, oh, this is going to be AML. What you see is a bigger cytoplasm, but it's got a bluer tone than the ALL cell. Once again, it's all a matter of how they did the stain, what they did with things, so don't go crazy about it, because the pathologists are going to help me out, okay? Okay. So we're going to induce with a lot of chemotherapy. These patients end up in the hospital for every cycle of chemotherapy. They do four. So they come in, they get their chemotherapy, they stay for a month. They go home for a week, they come back in, they stay for a month. They come back. So it's very family-intensive, patient-intensive therapy. And we're doing that because the risk of dying from infection during this chemotherapy is too high. A subset of kids, now we're teasing them out, and a subset of kids are high risk. If you came from MDS, you're too high risk. The mutation, there's something wrong. Remember I said way early in those, I call them low-quality stem cells? The MDS kids have something way early, okay? And so we can go in there and we can give chemo, but we're not going to get to that clone. If you ever have somebody that you have to explain it to, this is an explanation that one of my mentors gave, so I won't push on it. It's like cutting grass. Leukemia, ALL, is like mowing the lawn. There's a weed there, you just keep mowing it, eventually it dies, because it doesn't have a deep root. But there's going to be one of those weeds that has the deepest root. And you can mow all you want, you're not going to get it. A transplant gets that cell. Digging deep gets that cell, and that's what a transplant does. Okay? So that's how I sort of tell families. We can mow and mow and mow, and that's what ALL therapy does. But sometimes we need to dig deep and do a transplant. So where do you guys come in? Okay. So I happened to be at Hopkins when they started making the different FLT3, well, the person who found the FLT3 ITD is there. And so they started making the different ones, but we have other ones. And so these are coming into our use. And the problem with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, with the exception of, Gleevec has a little bit more limited effects, is that they affect many of the tyrosine kinases, depending on the family. But we use the tyrosine kinase inhibitors with a growing frequency if we can find something that we can block. We can use histone acetylase, deacetylase inhibitors. They can be valproic acid. We can use new agents. We're finding them. If you type in these words into the computer, they're exploding, okay? And this is where we're going to make a difference in both adult and pediatric cancer, is on understanding the biology, understanding the science behind our tumors. DNA hypomethylating agents, both of these agents were actually developed for chemo, but they didn't work very well because we didn't give them the right way because we tried to give them big doses. Now we give low doses, we change the pattern, and it replicates differently. So I have salvaged a number of children who do not care how much chemo you give them, but you give them a little azacitidine at low dose, and their leukemia cares, okay? So understanding that by changing the methylation pattern or the histone pattern, we are changing the way in which that tumor cell acts. We are using targeted therapy and as well as immune modulation. So I thought I had a slide for that one. Fudge. No. For instance, the targeted therapy, I have an antibody with that goes after CD33. Okay? And I stick a anthracycline on it, I stick a drug on it that was too toxic when I gave it to you as I infused it. But I stick an antibody on it, and then it goes like a missile to that tumor cell. Okay? That's the kind of things that people are working on. And I'm going to show you more of those in Hodgkin's. Okay? Hodgkin's. You guys are all at risk because you guys are in your adolescence and mid-20s, right? If you, it's very rare to see a patient that's less than 5 with Hodgkin's disease. And we start to think, could there be something else going on, like an immunodeficiency? In the United States, our most common is nodular sclerosis. Okay? I'm not going to write a test question that says, if you should know, okay? NS, okay? Interestingly, if you're Hispanic, and this is what we're trying to sort out, whether it's your genes or where you grew up, it's mixed cellularity, okay? So you start to tease that out. It's usually considered a painless adenopathy. It isn't, oh, I have a sore throat and now this thing hurts. This thing just starts to grow very slowly and insidiously, usually. A lot of ours end up supraclavicular, so up here, in cervical, and then in our axilla. Adults shouldn't have axillary lymph nodes. that we can feel. They're firm, they don't feel right. And I tell fellows, just keep feeling normal. And you'll go, that's not normal sometimes. So this young man obviously has something that doesn't look normal there. And we'll go and biopsy it. It spreads contiguously. So our staging goes, you have it in one place, now you have it in two, you have it in three, you have it up, three is above and below the diaphragm, four, it got out into the blood and went someplace. So it likes to stick together. Something happens to the lymphoma that makes it separate and go to a stage four. We're going to stage them, and then we're going to decide on therapy. Don't worry about this as much, but our therapy is chemotherapy and radiation, okay, predominantly. And what we're doing as pediatric oncologists is if I radiate a big area right here and you're a 12-year-old boy, I got to actually even you out where you're going to be. If this growth plate doesn't grow and this one does, things are not going to be shaped right. Dr. Rebecca is going to talk to you. We ended up with a bunch of young ladies with breast cancer because we got their breast spots, okay, in our radiation field. So we start to have to really think about the growing child and what we do later for these patients. If they reoccur, we move on to giving them high doses of chemotherapy. But is that really the right way? Oh, wait, we got new ideas now. The one that is going through the most right now and has just moved into phase three trials is to take CD30, it's on all the Hodgkin cells, right? And hook it on to something that's going to deliver the chemical right to the abnormal cell. Okay? So that's brentuximab. Okay? So if we can give you brentuximab and drop your bleomycin, you won't have the lung problems as you get older. Okay? That's our hope. So we're trying to move that forward. What if we take an anti-CD33? Well, we do that, and what we're trying to do is actually to go in for the immune system, take out the macrophages that are spitting out stuff that tell all of the cells that surround those little leukemia or lymphoma cells to be quiet. We want to wake them up. A Hodgkin's tumor is a bunch of tumor cells, Reed, Sternberg, and Hodgkin cells, surrounded by what is normal lymphocytes who are ignoring them. Okay? So this is trying to tell them to stop ignoring them. So how many of you guys are in immunology? So that's what you're trying to do. So it's the idea of the tumor infiltrating lymphocytes. It's the idea of breaking tolerance and trying to get these cells to wake up and do their job. Okay? That's the plain version of it. Okay? Okay. In pediatric oncology, moving on to the next common thing, we only have high grades. It's very rare to get a low-grade tumor. So when we have a lymphoma, we got to move quickly, okay? We don't have a mantle cell and we'll start therapy in a couple weeks. You should come back right now because you could have a mediastinal mass that's pushing on your airway. We have different types of presentations, but for the most part, ours in Africa, they tend to be head and neck. In the United States, they tend to be abdominal or thoracic. They can have adenopathy other places, but this thing is growing so fast, it will outstrip everything it's being fed by. And so you have to get them in because the left tumor lysis, they are breaking up all their cells. The DNA and RNA is spilling out. Their potassium is spilling out. They can get in trouble very quickly. And so we get them in there, and we try to diagnose them and start their therapy ASAP. There are multiple types. One of them is T lymphoblastic, and just like that sounds, that's often right here, okay? Because it's in the thymus. The cells are smart enough to get to the thymus, but not smart enough to leave the thymus. These kids can have so much pressure on return of blood flow that their heads actually can't return the blood flow, and they turn blue. And you have to get them open and start to and get the therapy started as fast as possible. Sometimes we have to use radiation. Okay. Have you guys seen one of these X-rays? Okay, so what you're looking at, this is a normal X-ray. And I'm not an expert, but I usually know what isn't right. Okay, so you've got your heart, and you've got your arch, okay? And this is a nice narrow system. This is what we're looking for, because that's where the thymus is sitting. Okay? So here's our thymus. And it's in March. Sometimes it's other lymph nodes there too. And we actually measure to see how wide that is. But you can imagine that if this thing surrounds that airway, see that dark line? That's your airway. You could actually have impending respiratory arrest. Okay, so we're going to be very aggressive with chemotherapy, and we're going to do well. You know what the biggest problem with this group of patients is? If you can get them to survive their first presentation, they're going to be at risk of they're going to be cured. And the problem with that is that we now have patients that have toxicity, but we need to figure out how we can start separating those kids off. Okay? So we have less toxicity and still have a good cure. So that's where drugs like rituximab come in. Okay. Brain tumors. And then the picture didn't come through very well. It's the most common solid tumor because it's actually a mix of tumors. And it depends on where it is. Now I'm going to show you a slide that says, okay, the upper part of your brain and the lower, the different parts of your brain. This is the brain tumor sedumus. Supratentorial, infratentorial, okay? If they're up here, you tend to have seizures, you tend to not do as well, you tend to have changes in handedness, you tend to not be thinking quite right. If you have tumors down here, you block the flow of spinal fluid, and you end up with a problem of all the symptoms of increased ICP, like headaches and changes in your eyes, okay? See? Did you like the very simplified upper, lower? So they can have some changes. I'm going to put these here so that you have them, but I want to get a little bit to the biology of this. We have had these tumors, and what we know is pediatric patients do great. Why? Because they have a WHO classification 1. They have pyelocytic astrocytomas. We cut them out. They grow slow. Not a big deal. Unless it's in a bad part of your brain for cutting it out. What do adults get? Anybody? That depends on my first thing. GBMs, glioblastoma multiforming, and that's the thing. They get far more, and they're almost GBS, and they're almost always spread through the brain. So I can't get it all out. So Dr. Funstermacher here at Roswell is trying to make you make a vaccine so that you attack it. Okay? You attack what I got left, what you have left. There's roles for many get radiation. Remember, I already told you, I told Dr. Bocacca just came in. So I've been telling them how you're going to tell them that they're not, that it's finished and we have a lot of ongoing problems. We also use chemotherapy depending on what we have. And we give chemotherapy to the littler kids to delay the radiation so that they end up being kids that can function in the world. Okay, see? I told you. Really quite easy. Infratentorial, supratentorial, okay? So we know where, when we look under the microscope, when we look at the MRIs, we know basically, oh, it's there. I bet you it's going to be a pineoblastoma. Oh, it's there. That's going to be a medulloblastoma. If it's here, and it's only within this area right here, we call that a brainstem glioma. In children, we have never yet figured out how to cure that patient. So each of them can be sort of figured out by where you are. So once again, how have we done this? We've given the same chemotherapy to everybody. Here's a little picture of a medulla. So it's sitting, not supposed to be there. See it? Okay. It's a different color than the rest of them. Once again, not on your chest. Okay. So along comes the scientist, because this is oncology for science. And instead of just looking at this tumor and saying a medulloblastoma is a medulloblastoma, we've started to be able to resect those and start looking at what we have. And so there is a family that is involving the WNT pattern signaling. There is one that involves the SHH pattern. There's within this group NMIP amplification. Group 3 has NMIP amplification. And then group 4 has become the mission of everybody else, but includes NF-kappa B signaling, and so they don't have as much amplification. Now, if we tease them out, instead of just saying, under the microscope, it's a medulloblastoma, these guys, looking retrospectively, have a 94% cure rate. These guys have a 32%. We're doing badly on this group. We're probably over-treating that group and giving them late effects. Okay? We got to figure out the pattern. We got to be able to find targeted therapies and immune therapies to be able to get to these tumors and decrease our side effects. And each of these tumor types are going to start, we're going to start to learn more and more. Okay, so remember, most of ours are not medullos. Most of them are pilocytic astrocytomas. Cut them out and we're fine. Medullos is one of our groups that is chemosensitive, and it also now we can tease them out and not just be, well, they have a met, they don't have a met, metastasis. I'm going to go fairly quickly through the rest of these in the interest of objective, okay? But I wanted, when I looked at this list and said, oh, I got all of pediatric oncology, it's too much, but I think that you guys need to know, have some idea. One of the groups is Wilms tumors. This is the most common kidney tumor. And so it's the mom who feels the belly and says there's something there. These are kids that, remember I started this by saying, you start it's these cancers occur when they're supposed to be developing. And so it's the, if you want it. And so this is a tumor of the developing kidney. But there are a couple of syndromes that this goes along with. Wagner syndrome and Beckwith-Wiedemann, they are overgrowth syndromes. So I have a young man who is on my Facebook, who, he is huge. And I can look at him and go, half of his face is bigger than the other half of his face. His whole body is bigger than it should be for his age. But he's got the one side is totally overgrown. And you can see it in his arms and legs when he's in pictures. But you know, I could spot it, but you know, most people wouldn't have paid attention to it. But if you have an overgrowth of cells, he's at risk of those cells going on to forming a cancer. And he did. He had a Wilms tumor. Okay, neuroblastoma. This is one where, once again, you guys can help. And where basic science really did help. And this is where the cure. This is a tumor that is portable. The biologists that have been involved in neuroblastoma have been working a long time. They know that certain mutations make these kids higher risk, and they present higher risk. So what we are all teasing apart is, why are some kids metastatic from the beginning? It isn't a matter of, oh, the mother didn't pay attention. They are simply metastatic from the beginning, and some kids are localized from the beginning and stay that way. And so the high-risk kids tend to be the ones that are, for most part, you can be non-metastatic and just have very angry tumor under the microscope, or it can be widely spread to make you a high-risk kid. And why I say this is important, and I didn't put the growth patterns on, is we're going to give them so much therapy, their bodies, it's amazing their body holds together. We're going to come in and we're going to give them multiple cycles of chemotherapy. We're going to come in and rate, and then we're going to cut out the main tumor. Then we're going to radiate everywhere that the main tumor or the tumor is found, as well as any bulky disease we have left. And then this is where the difference was. This is where the laboratory came to the clinic. We're going to give them Accutane, pretty good doses of Accutane. Why? Because it matures neuroblastoma cells, and we make them stop dividing. So the kids get 6 cycles of Accutane at high dose, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, to get any microscopic disease to mature. And then along came, let's make an antibody. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to make an antibody to the tumor cell, and then we're going to modulate your immune system to make it go find, to stimulate it even more. So these kids get GM-CSF, IL-2, and an antibody. The antibody has cross-reactivity with normal neural cells, so it hurts. We do it in the hospital. We put them on pain medicine. But right now, that has jumped the survival considerably. But you can imagine that that child has just gone through all of that, and now maybe we've gotten a 70% cure rate. If they've survived, they don't hear very well. They've lost high frequency. We don't know what's going to happen the rest of their lives. And we still need help teasing these kids out, backing up on therapy, giving more directed therapy. Okay. And we won't go through all that. There's a big mediastinal mass. I've talked about it. They attract MIBG. Remember, I gave you extra stuff because I knew that pediatric oncology is a little bit hard to cover. And then the last major group, and then I'll hand it over to Dr. Rebecca, is the sarcomas. And you can have it, we group them together, osteosarcoma and Ewing sarcoma. They probably are not really something that we should group together, except for the fact that they occur in the bone and the muscle. And so osteosarcoma tends to be a disease of the growing child, okay? So it's the it tends to be an adolescent. If you have a P53 mutation, you can get your osteosarcoma anytime. If you have a retinoblastoma mutation, you can get your osteosarcoma. And so there's different ages, there's different reasons. But what we know about osteosarcoma is that if you present with osteosarcoma and it's localized disease, and I cut off your leg and say, that's okay, that's all you need, 80% of you will come back with micromets to your lungs that now grow. That primary tumor is holding those lungs at bay. There's still so much we need to learn. People have been starting to tease apart the proteins, but there's got to be something about the immune system too. But the primary can tell the micromets did not do anything. And so we know that we have to give chemotherapy, do local control, and then come back with more chemotherapy, where those kids will relapse in their lungs even if we never saw it. Okay? So when we talk about the science of the oncology for scientists, that's a whole group of research people are looking at. Why do the cells break off? What is going on? And why does an osteosarcoma patient who had this big a tumor and have widely metastatic lung disease? And somebody else can have a big, huge tumor this big and have nothing. We don't understand. What we do know is that we're going to stage them and look. And so what you see here, look at that. Here's calcium. There's bone outside of the bone. Okay? We're going to get to another one that is always amazing. It's Ewing's. Also, we consider one of those bone cancers. We have very similar. We have adjuvant therapy. We do local control. We do chemotherapy afterwards. This population of patients can present with a very small tumor, have widely metastatic disease, have symptoms that go along with having massive cytokine release, fevers, weight loss, the whole bit. Those can be very bad flares. Another kid can come with a very large primary and have none of them, okay? And we don't have a stage for Ewing's. They're either metastatic or localized, just like the osteosarcomas. And we don't cure the metastatics. We need help, okay? Here's another interesting fact. Who knows, maybe this we have a test. If this child was black, I wouldn't put Ewing's in my differential very high, because there's something about being African-American that protects you from Ewing's. They don't get it, only in the 1 to 2% range. We don't understand that. If we could understand why, maybe we could cure the kids that come in with widely metastatic disease. So theirs tends to be further up on the bone, not near the growth plate, and they tend to onion. They tend to bulk like this, not have a bunch of calcium. So we put a rod in and put a new bone. Okay. I'm going to end there. Do you guys have any questions? And we'll let Dr. Rebecca come up.
If there's an auto moment, will
they see
that you're compromised for the rest of their life?
No. And if there's a pediatric and an adult tumor, an auto will usually, you'll be, depending on what you see, 34 select, meaning it takes more stem cells. If you don't see the selective auto, you'll be immunocompetent in about 4 months. If you do, it's more like an allo, except to about 6 months post. Allos, because your immune system is learning, and it's you transplanted an immune system, it's not like a liver. I can wean off immunosuppression because they can learn to talk, okay? And they actually replace antigen presentation. Okay?
He's up there. He's coming. Mm-hmm. Here's that.
Oh, this here. Oh, is that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he's coming. He's coming. Okay, no problem. Okay.
Is the slide you emailed me, are those okay?
Yep.
Oh, it's already loaded up.
All right. What do I need to do here?
Just go down
okay.
to the...
Yep, Oh, we do let people come and visit. If you want to talk to Margaret Raymiller, the head of our team will let you figure out a way to shadow a little bit of something.
So I took this class I don't know, 8 years ago now. So I got my master's in public health and during my fellowship. So I understand you're probably getting close to five. People want to go home, so we're going to try and make this quick. So basically, I'm going to talk more about cancer survivorship. In the early 80s, cancer survivorship was recognized as something that may be a consideration and something that we needed to look into a little bit more. So really what we're going to talk about are kind of the complications of pediatric cancer, the treatments that we give, and what we need to do in terms of screening and early detection. So I'm not sure if Dr. Haven went over some of these things, but basically if you look at the cancer incidence, you can see that there's a clear pattern of increase over the last several decades, which is concerning, probably environmental related, but who knows. We don't really know why kids get cancer. Genetics may play a role, environments may play a role, but we don't really know the whole story. So if you look at our survival rates, if you compare this, so this is from SEER statistics from, I think, 2012. So if you look at survival rates overall, we're at 84%. So we're doing pretty good. We have a lot of ALL survivors, lots of Hodgkin survivors, and Wilms tumor survivors. If you look at similar graphs from the 1960s, 1970s, really we were somewhere around 20% for all diseases. So we've done great things, but we also know that there is quite a difference between the general U.S. population, so that yellow line, versus the childhood cancer survivor population. So there's clearly a 20% decline in, or a 20% increase, whatever I'm trying to say, increase in mortality in cancer survivors. So that's a problem, you know, and what we know is that there are certain reasons why. We also know, so the bottom graph is really just looking again at the U.S. population, males, females, and then again, males, females. So, you know, females in general tend to go to the doctors more often, so they're probably getting detected late effects earlier than male survivors. Nonetheless, there's a clear difference between cancer survivors and the general U.S. population. So why is that? Well, so the biggest risk is going to be recurrence from your original tumor. So that's really within the first 5 to 10 years or so after cancer therapy. And then we kind of follow that up by secondary cancers, so cancers that are developed because of what therapy we've given. And then cardiac, respiratory, and then kind of other. The other is really just the general, probably equivalent to the regular U.S. population, suicides, accidents, things like that. So survivors are an interesting group. They don't always have complete knowledge of their diagnosis, their treatment. 30% can't accurately tell you what they had. 10% don't recall receiving chemotherapy. 30 to 50 don't recall receiving anthracyclines. That's important, and we'll get to that in a little bit. 30% are unaware that they even have any risk for late effects. And 10% don't even remember receiving radiation. Now, some of that is probably because they were maybe 2 when they were diagnosed, and so they wouldn't remember all of that detail. And we also have a fair amount of people that stop following up after they feel like they've been cured. So what are late effects? Basically long-term side effects from chemotherapy, radiation therapy, surgeries, transplant, any kind of therapy that they've received for their cancer. They can happen while you're getting therapy, within months from finishing some therapy, or years later. So the important thing really to think when you're trying to think about what are the risks for that particular patient, so it's very patient-specific. So location and extent of the primary disease, type and doses of cancer therapy, so how much anthracyclines did they get, how much radiation did they get, any genetic predispositions. I know Dr. Hibman kind of mentioned a little bit, so retinoblastoma gene and those sorts of things, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And then just host factors, males versus females, there's different risks, health habits, are you eating healthy, are you exercising regularly, are you smoking, age at the time of treatment, so younger kids tend to have more late effects because they're still growing, have growing tissues. And then era of treatment. So obviously what we do now for Hodgkin's disease in 2017 is different from what we did in 1980. So, again, just a little bit about the genetics. The more common ones that I've seen over the years are the retinoblastoma gene, as Dr. Hagman mentioned, retinoblastoma, but also some soft tissue sarcomas. We don't tend to see BRCA genes in pediatrics. Not that they don't occur, but we just don't see it. NF1, we have a lot of optic glioma pathway kids, so brain tumor kids that will also be at risk for sorts of other, you know, cancers later in life. P53 mutations are very rare. I have one kid that has a P53 mutation, was diagnosed with two different cancers at 9 months of age, and then diagnosed with a brain tumor 10 years later. So it's important to recognize these syndromes when you do see them, because there's different screening recommendations. And then von Hippel-Lindau is the other one that I've seen. I haven't really seen the others. So late effects. So this slide is really just trying to show you in somebody who is 24-year-old survivor, so they have somewhere around, you know, 20% risk, it's about the same as a 50-year-old sibling. So that's, and this is really just looking at chronic health conditions. So some of those health conditions can be obviously less life-threatening than others. Hypothyroidism can be treated with a pill. Another secondary cancer is a bit more intense. So, but this is kind of just a general. The second one is really just showing by age 50, so this line right here, 23% of survivors, the blue line, have either two or more life-threatening or severe disabling diseases. And these are, again, survivors to siblings. And then the last one is just trying to show you, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of a weird way to show it, but basically if you are healthy within 10 years, you're going to have some sort of secondary late effect, about 25%. So. So again, we talked about the kinds of late effects we see. So new cancers are really the biggest one we see, and you can see that quite the difference between survivors and siblings in terms of incidence, cardiac issues, hearing issues, vision issues. Pretty much any system in the body, you can say there's potential for some sort of problem depending on what kind of therapy they've gotten. And I'm not going to go through every detail with you, because that's just not really what this is trying to teach you. Really, you just need to know that there's late effects and there's problems. So this is a similar graph. It just breaks it up by disease site. So leukemia survivors, somewhere around a 30% incidence of late effects. CNS survivors, you know, 50% late effects. Our CNS brain tumor patients tend to have a lot of late effects just because of where their tumor is located. And our Hodgkin survivors, those are kind of the three populations that have the highest risk for late effects. So any cancer experience, again, is going to potential. Ew, there's a spider over there. any kind of psychosocial issues. So there are a host of patients that are more at risk for some of these things. So things like smoking, drinking, risky sorts of behavior, poor diet, lack of exercise. Those tend to be more of the adolescents, patients that have been diagnosed in their adolescence. But if you look at survivors as a whole, they generally are a pretty healthy group. They try to be healthy. They really seem to recognize that they've had cancer once. They don't want to have it again. But there's also, you know, increased risk for not finishing out school, increased risk for poor body image, self-esteem. And some of that, again, is age at diagnosis. A lot of our adolescents, they miss out on that real important social interaction phase in their life. So that becomes really hard for them to kind of reintegrate into a normal lifestyle. So you sometimes see social withdrawals. And then we see a host of mental health disorders. Typically, the most common thing I see is anxiety. But depression, post-traumatic stress, chronic fatigue. I have patients that the moment they know they're coming in to Roswell to have their survivorship clinic visit, they get all anxious, their blood pressure goes up, they feel nauseous, you know, the whole way in, which is a horrible thing, and hopefully that's not me, but nonetheless, it's something that we have to address as well. And again, so risk factors, adolescent, young adults, females are more at risk if they've had prior traumas, physical abuse, things like that, previous mental health history, including family mental health history. poor support system, low socioeconomic status, and particularly patients that are brain tumor survivors or have gone through bone marrow transplant are at higher risk as well. So I sort of tried to divide this up into chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, just to kind of give you an overarching picture of what sorts of things you need to worry about. So anthracyclines are important, as cytotoxins, alkylating agents, radiation, and then bone marrow. I didn't really focus on bone marrow transplant because there's a whole host of issues with that, but so let's talk about anthracyclines because it's one of the most commonly used drugs that we see. We use it for ALL, we use it for Hodgkin's, we use it for all sarcomas, we use it in neuroblastomas, we use it in Wilms. So pretty much most of the things we see, we're using some sort of anthracycline. So anthracyclines can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. What happens as you're getting the drug is you get some cardiomyocyte death, and other cardiomyocytes have to kind of compensate for that. And over time, that fails. And so these kids get this dilated cardiomyopathy. They can end up having poor heart failure over time as well. This, as I said, mentioned earlier, this can happen while you're giving this drug, but it can happen many years later. And it's dose dependent, it's age dependent, and it's radiation dependent. So this is actually an image from the Children's Oncology Group. So that's kind of our national group that we get all of our kind of chemotherapy protocols from. What this is just depicting is kind of what I just said. So age at treatment, radiation, what dose of anthracycline, and then how often should we be following echoes? We know that kids that have gotten over 300 milligrams per meter squared tend to have a higher incidence of having heart failure. So those kids are followed more frequently. There's a lot of studies now trying to look at using Zinicard as a cardioprotectant while you're getting your doxorubicin. The preliminary data looks like it does have some heart protection, and so hopefully that will continue to pan out. We also are trying to risk stratify our patients a little bit more. I'm not sure if Dr. Hickman mentioned that, but so with our kids with leukemia, there's a low risk, there's a standard risk, and there's a high risk. Only the high risk kids tend to get more anthracycline. So again, you know, in the past 10 years, one of the big focus of the Children's Oncology Group is to kind of pull back therapy from the kids that we are doing really well with. So our ALL patients, our Hodgkin's patients, they have greater than 90% cure rate, and so can we eliminate some chemotherapy but still get the same cure rate, because obviously we wouldn't want to compromise cure either. So these kids can also have other issues, so arrhythmias and valvular issues. The valvular issues tend to be patients that have had radiation as well. Pericardial disease sometimes, and then you can see the dramatic difference between those patients that have had over 250 milligrams per meter squared of anthracycline versus those that haven't. And then this is again just showing the radiation and the valvular disease. Obviously, you see that's kind of off the charts in heart failure. MI is interesting. So we don't have a ton of survivors that are in their 50s and 60s because remember we just started curing kids a lot in the 80s and 90s. So we're learning more and more. These survivors seem to have MI earlier than you would typically see, and that's probably somewhat related to radiation, maybe related to anthracyclines as well. Radiation can cause fibrosis in the vessels around the heart, and so that may be why these survivors are getting MI earlier. So secondary cancers, we know that epidophyllotoxins, so etoposide, all the anthracyclines that I previously mentioned, and alkylating agents can cause secondary leukemias. The secondary leukemia that it causes is specific for a translocation Q1123. It tends to be really hard to treat and cure. Typically, if that's going to happen, it's within the first 5 to 10 years after therapy. And then transplant and radiation are also risk factors for other sorts of secondary cancers. So what kind of secondary cancers do we see? Typically, our most common are breast, thyroid, CNS tumors, and leukemia. Our Hodgkin survivors have been the most studied in terms of secondary malignancies because we have a lot of them and they've gotten a lot of therapy as well as radiation therapy. if you notice this number here. So these are female Hodgkin survivors are at a 30-fold increased risk of breast cancer. That risk starts somewhere around age 30. So these survivors actually get mammograms and breast MRIs starting at age 25, which is pretty early, 15 years earlier than typical. Thyroid cancer, again, is more commonly related to radiation. So anytime, you know, your thyroid is in the radiation port. And then we see a lot of basal cell carcinomas. So in my clinic, we talk a lot about healthy diet, healthy living, using sunscreen, and really it's more of an educational visit than it is a typical cancer visit. So some of our chemotherapy can cause infertility and premature ovarian failure. It can cause oligospermia and mass. So typically, ifosfamide, cytoxin are the two that we use nowadays. In the 80s and 90s, we used to use a lot of nitrogen mustard, dacarbazine, and percarbazine. Fortunately, we don't use those that much anymore because they did cause a lot of secondary cancers as well as infertility. So one of the educational pieces that we talk with my survivors as well is that, you know, you've been exposed to these drugs. You may be infertile. We don't know unless we test. So when you're 25 and you're deciding, do I put all of myself into my career, or do I need to sort of divide my career and my family before I hit ovarian failure and menopause, early menopause, is a discussion that has to be had. Some of our survivors get a fair amount of steroids. Our leukemia patients get a lot of steroids. So they are at risk for avascular necrosis. Avascular necrosis is a lack of blood flow to the joints. Typically, if it's going to happen, it's in bigger joints, so hips and knees and shoulders. Basically, lots of pain, lots of chronic joint pain, and sometimes it needs joint replacement. We do see osteopenia and osteoporosis as well in our survivors that have had a lot of steroids. So we, you know, do screening with bone density in patients that have had a lot of steroids just to kind of follow up and see if there's something more we should be doing for them. And then pulmonary fibrosis. So bleomycin historically has caused an accelerated pulmonary fibrosis. What can happen actually? So I have all of our patients we talk about no scuba diving, and if you're going under general anesthesia for anything, it's important to let your anesthesiologist know that you've been exposed to this drug. Because what happens is, so the oxygen can create free radicals in the lungs. And so as you're descending, like if you're scuba diving, as you're descending into the ocean, the partial pressure of oxygen goes up in your lungs, and that can actually accelerate fibrosis. So it's recommended that anybody who's had bleomycin never scuba dive. And so basically the same mechanism for anesthesia. Anesthesiologists historically love to just take that oxygen and crank it right up. So it's important to just mention it to them as well. So radiation, we talked a little bit about this, but so our brain tumor survivors, a lot of their issues come from their radiation as well as surgeries to wherever that brain tumor was. Cranial radiation can cause problems with growth hormone deficiency, bone formation, especially if they're little, metabolic issues, complete endocrine dysfunction, hearing loss, visual disturbances, cataracts, dental caries, and then a whole host of neurocognitive deficits. So we tend to see neurocognitive deficits more so in our brain tumor survivors and our leukemia survivors. And that's just because of the function of what medicines they get and how old they are when they're diagnosed. Methotrexate has historically been known to cause a lot of neurocognitive deficits. So the things that we see, these kids can look very much like ADHD kids in the sense that they have problems with planning, organizing, staying on task. And then the learning issues, usually it's reading comprehension and math that they struggle with. And then, so any radiation, again, we mentioned the secondary malignancies, secondary brain tumors, thyroid problems, breast, and thyroid cancer. Any radiation given to the liver or spleen may cause dysfunction later on in life as well. Specifically with the spleen, you are worried about things like encapsulated organisms, so meningitis and strep pneumonia. So these patients need to be immunized on a regular basis to try and decrease any risk that they have. And then any radiation to the pelvis or the abdomen that's kind of generalized can cause premature births for women, low birth weight babies, and small for gestational age babies. So it's important for women to also recognize that risk. And this is a great study, but I put it in here because it maybe shows that there's a little bit smaller babies. But really, these are kind of equivalent to me. But anyways. And then skin cancer, I mentioned already. So skin cancer that we see, again, is not typically melanoma, but it off 90% of the time is in radiation port. So depending on where your radiation is, if that's also a sun-exposed area, it's important to use sunscreen when you're out. So this is just another slide that I threw in here because it shows, obviously, this dramatic difference between brain tumor patients who have gotten a lot of radiation versus a little radiation in terms of their other secondary cancers and stroke risk. So those, typically, our brain tumor patients do get over 50 gray of radiation. So their stroke risk is obviously much higher than somebody who's never gotten. In addition, these patients can have carotid artery disease, which puts them at a higher risk for stroke as well. So surgery, not as many complications unless it's a brain tumor, but if you've had an abdominal tumor and you've had multiple abdominal surgeries, you can have adhesions that can cause chronic bowel obstructions, chronic abdominal pain, and poor motility. So some of these patients have chronic constipation, chronic issues related to that as well. Musculoskeletal surgical problems. Some patients will have limb length discrepancies, so they may have to wear a lift in their shoe to make them not walk imbalanced and be uncomfortable. They can have chronic pain from any of the joint replacements that they've had. So all of our sarcoma, our bone tumors, tend to get that bone taken out, so and then a rod of some sort. Titanium is what we're using these days to replace it. Typically, these patients will have to have another surgery at least every 15 to 20 years to either replace the joint or revise it. And then any disability. So years ago, we used to do amputations for every kind of bone tumor. We don't do that anymore, which is good and bad. So patients that have had limb-sparing surgeries and have these rods in place still have morbidities with chronic pain and other issues. And then one of the things survivors come to me a lot about is whether or not they're going to affect any offspring that they have. The good news is not really. We don't, in a study done with survivors versus siblings, it didn't appear to be any difference in chromosomal syndromes, any difference in gene disorders, or major congenital malformations, which is good. So again, this is just kind of the stuff we've been talking about extensively, but health maintenance, exposure-related screening, you know, whether or not you need an echo or not, how often, breast MRIs, mammograms, and then education, risk reduction in terms of, you know, avoiding smoking, avoiding too much alcohol, you know, using sunscreen when you're out. And then this link at the bottom, so there is like a 200-page document within the Children's Oncology Group that goes through each and every drug, each and every surgery, each and every radiation, in terms of the late effects that are associated with them as well. And then the last slide is the good news. So in the 70s, here we were with all chronic health conditions being pretty high, and here we are in the 90s. So and hopefully in the 2000s, we're somewhere down here too, in terms of late effects. So that's good. We are doing something. We need to do more, but nonetheless, We're getting somewhere. That's it. Questions? All right.